The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. There was a recent gathering in Throssell for the order, and I wasn't able to go, but I was listening to the tapes, and one of the younger monks was talking about coming to this practice because he wanted a challenge. So I want to challenge people today to go beyond their comfort zone. We live in a society where we're sold the delusion that we've got to be comfortable all the time. And that doesn't always happen. Which is where the Buddha's teaching starts. That the first noble truth is that there's suffering is just inherent in the nature of being a person. And it's what we do with that. Since we just did a memorial for River Master Ji, who I was going to talk about, the first time I ever heard her talk, and a lot of that is, the metaphor that she gave was the going beyond this door to the unknown. In San Francisco in 1970, I just lost a job and I was feeling really unhappy. And I walked around San Francisco for 4 or 5 hours and I found myself in front of a Zen center. And I started to go in and there was a door on the sign on the door says, "Go away, we're closed for sesshin. Come back in a week." And I got about a half a block away, and I remember this story from Kafka. He wasn't always one for being bright, too bright-minded. But it was a story about the man from the country who's very shy and retiring, and he comes to the gate of the law, and there's a being there, somewhat like Fudomyo here, who is kind of fierce and mean-looking, and the door was open, but the man from the country was too shy to go in, but every once in a while he'd try to go, and the guard would say, "Well, you know, there's 1,000 doors beyond this one, and they all have guards that are just as mean, if not meaner and uglier than I am," and of course, I'm temporarily reading my own version of the story. So he's about to die, and the guard walks over and says, "That door was meant only for you." So I got the message. Okay, so I turned around, I went back to Zen Center, and I knocked on another door. Different door that didn't have a sign on it. I got let in, and they were having tea and a cookie, and I couldn't really hear what the Suzuki Roshi was saying, but they told me afterwards that I could come back the next morning at 5:30. And so I did. And after the sitting, they said that Kenneth Roshi was giving a talk that week. So I went on Wednesday night and listened to her talk, and she talked a little bit about how there isn't any competition in Buddhism between the various sects. In Japan, there's Soto and Rinzai, but one of the abbots thinks that one of his disciples would be better off in a Rinzai monastery, he would just send them there. And there wasn't sort of any competition that one way was better than the other. You just have to find the one that works for you, or the one you're willing to work within. It's more the question. And She talked a little bit about her training in Japan, and then she told this story about an SS officer from World War II, and I'm sure many of you have heard me tell this story before, but it's his job was to mete out punishment for people convicted of espionage. And Rev. Master Jiyu had been through World War II during the Blitz, the German bombing, and she lived in southern England, and one night she was just walking along the beach and somebody just shoved her down against the seawall and a German plane went right over their heads, and she would have died had she not been. This stranger just did it that at the right time. So she was not a friend of the SS. And but this man was not tried as a war criminal, because he gave people a choice. He had two doors behind his desk, and he said, they were both painted black. He said, this one is the firing squad. I can't tell you what this one is, but you get your choice. And when I first heard that story, I thought, what kind of torture have they come up with? It's worse than the firing squad. And I wasn't so sure that I would be taking that door. But she said, this is Buddhist training, this door to the unknown. And he had, the officer had a car with its engine running, waiting to take anybody across the Swiss border who had the courage to take it. And this is where we're challenged in Buddhist practice, is to realize that we have to change our habits. We have to go beyond what's familiar. And every day we're confronted with something we don't like or don't want or don't have or don't want to have. We're always, something will happen in a day where it's not quite like what we'd like it to be. And in our culture, most of the time people are encouraged to find a way to fix the outside so that you can be comfortable. And the Buddha's practice is to learn to fix the inside. In the Sandokaya it says, with the ideal comes the actual, like a box all with its lid. Which means that the actual is in fact the ideal. And it doesn't always look like that. And what has to change here is how we change our perceptions. When River Master was training in Japan, she was a Western woman in an all-male monastery. One of the officers had to lose their job in order for her teacher to get a consensus of the officers to have her come in as a monk. And although she'd been ordained in Malaysia, she was in the guest house for 3 months until they sorted this out. And the way they sorted this out was somebody had to lose their job. And Gisko Hozenji needed a consensus of the officers to admit her into the monastery. And and so in her diary, she, very in a British understatement, she said, the new director came to greet her, which meant the old director wasn't there anymore, and that the new director got the job because he would agree to having her in the monastery. And she didn't explain how some of the friends of the old director were not too happy with her being there. And there was also just the culture in Japan wasn't particularly open to having women in an all-male monastery. Kohozenji had this vision that women, as the Buddha said, could go just as far as men could in the training. There wasn't anything different in a spiritual sense from the ability for women to train. And we now live in a culture where that's possible. Although even in America, the Equal Rights Amendment did not pass because it needed 2/3 of the votes of all the states. And there's still a lot of places in which women are not equal. If you look in Congress and in the Senate and a lot of our government offices, there was an interesting book someone gave me about the different cultures in the North America, and some of them are like the Puritan culture, some of them are cultures from a lot of people who settled from the English-Scottish border where they're always fighting one another. And there was a slave-owning culture, there was the Mexican-American culture, there were cultures on the West Coast which were very different from the cultures in the rest of the country. And the cultures in Canada, the last one he talked about was the Inuit culture. And he was interviewing one of the women who was the head of the government, actually. And she said, we have a secret weapon. The women are in charge. And in Japan, that idea of the women being in charge was relegated to the home. Actually, the women controlled the money and had a lot of control. They had worked out the system where the women were equal, but only in an unseen way. But one of the things that she describes in her diary was being beaten. And it sounds like it was unusual, but she was talking about the use of the kyosok, which we don't use anymore over here, because it's just the use of that kind of scares people. But the idea of the kyosok is to put your hands in gassho, and the disciplinarian who's walking around, when he sees somebody with their hands in gassho, he will give them a couple of whacks on both shoulders, because this brings up this muscle that gets tense in sitting, and it breaks through that tension if you know how to use it. But it was also sometimes used if the person carrying it didn't particularly like the person that they were confronting. So she got a lot of that, and she talks about that as being beaten with the kyosok. And it was one of the things she thought, maybe we didn't need that in this culture. And I remember being somewhat put off by the kyosok, and it took me a number of years of doing meditation before I really got around to looking for a teacher. And I found one. We had a really good deal here. She needed a lawyer and I needed a teacher. I think I got the better end of the job there. And what we're learning here is how to be aware of the fact that we create our suffering. The external circumstances are not the source of the problem. It's how we interpret these circumstances. And one of my favorite stories is about Yakuzan, who had been studying with Sekito for 20 years or more, and he still wasn't getting it. He wanted enlightenment, and he wasn't getting it. And I think his teacher got fed up at one point and sent him over to talk to Basso. And Basso listened to Yakuzan about his many years of studying, and he read everything he could read, and he still wasn't getting it. And Basso looks at him, I'm sure, with a little twinkle in his eye and a little grin on his face, saying, well, you know, sometimes I raise the eyebrows of old Shakyamuni and blink his eyes, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes it's a good thing to do, and sometimes it's not. He says, what do you think? Well, the penny drop finally dropped for Rakuzan, and he realized what he was doing, and his response to that was, when I was a Sekoto, I was like a mosquito trying to bite an iron bowl. He was trying to get blood out of a turnip. He was trying to get something, and he was looking at the world through this idea of inadequacy. He didn't have something he wanted to have. And he didn't realize that he had to change his perception. He didn't have to get something. He already had it. He had to let go of his wanting something other. I remember talking to a high school class near Santa Barbara, and I asked, well, what's suffering? And this young woman who couldn't have been more than about 14, she said, wanting things to be other than they are. And I think it was one of the Buddha's way of describing that too. On River Master Diyu's stupa, there's this quote about when life comes, there's only life. When death comes, there's only death. All acceptance is the key that unlocks the gateless gate. And that all acceptance is when you're confronted by things that are difficult or difficult people. I just heard a talk by Ajahn Brahm about difficult people. And he says, we all have them. This is why we live in the monastery. We're just full of difficult people. To the outside, it looks like, oh, they're all nice and smiley and whatever, and you don't see somebody getting upset and telling you exactly what they think. And that sometimes happens. There's a lovely book by Ajahn Sumedho. You don't even have to get beyond the title, but the title is the perfect part. Don't take your life personally. Well, that's exactly how we create suffering, is because we take our life personally. And what you're learning in Buddhist practice is how to be at ease. This is what the meditation and the keeping the precepts is all about. If you can keep the precepts, and if you can do your meditation every day, you put yourself in a position where you can be at ease. What you have to do is see all the places where you're not doing that. It's just like meditation. You notice that the mind is wandering. You see, oh, I'm not meditating. That's when you're meditating, is when you see you're not. And the same with keeping the precepts. When you see that you're breaking the precepts, when you can see where you're creating tension for yourself, when you see you're being critical of somebody else, when you see that you're getting angry, when you see that you're proud of myself and devaluing others, when you see that you're breaking the precepts, then you have the choice to let go of that and be at ease, or hold on to that and create more tension. And this is why we're suffering, is because we're not willing to see this all the time. We had a difficult person recently who was suffering from serious mental illness and serious delusion, and everybody else in the universe was causing her problems. And somebody tried to tell her, well, that's a clue. It may not be the rest of the universe. But when somebody is mentally ill, they can't make that shift to perception. They're perceiving through this glass of fog that the self creates. But we have to see that we have those glasses of self that we need to take off. They're very dark glasses too. And we're in a very bright room. We may not need these dark glasses. Being patient is one of my koans. I remember as a kid even wanting to interrupt my mother all the time if I wanted something. And She kept saying, well, you know, flattery will get you everywhere. If I could only be nice about it, it would be a lot better to get her attention. And being patient is one of those situations where you have to be there when you want something that isn't happening. And you need to just relax with that. It's just okay. Whatever's going on is okay. And if it's, we're late for something or you miss something or whatever, well, you do your best you can. But you don't have to get upset about it. You don't have to think that just because I need to convey this information or get something or do something that I have to get upset about it. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, every step is a prayer. So just if you have to take a few more steps than you were counting on, well, every step is a prayer if you make it that way. But it's this subtle shift in how we look at things. One of the past lives of the Buddha was of Kshantivartin, who was, Kshanti means patience, and he was a teacher of patience. And it's kind of a difficult story because this person was inherited the kingdom. He was the prince, and his father died, and he got the job, and he didn't want the job. And he wanted to go off and be a monk, and so he hands the job off to his very, very young baby brother and goes off and does his training. And his brother becomes an adult and takes over the reins on the kingdom. And at one point, he goes on a picnic in the jungle with his entourage. And he has a big meal and he falls asleep. And the rest of the people there say, well, let's go talk to Kshantivartin. He's just over there. And so they all get up and go and listen to this Dharma talk. And the king wakes up and nobody's there. And he's in a rage. So he goes around looking for the rest of his entourage and he finds them and he says, who are you? And he says, I'm Kshantivartin. So you're patient, are you? Okay, well, teach this. And he starts cutting off his arms and hands and legs and stuff. And this man really was not taking his life personally and was able just to sit there. And finally, when the king calms down a little bit, he was told just who he had just killed. And he was very remorseful at that point and died shortly thereafter, but he didn't realize he had just killed his brother. And but he had to take the consequences of his actions, and they were not insignificant. But Kshantivartin had developed this bodhisattva mind of being able to acknowledge the value of what other people were doing, even if it meant his own destruction. And not many of us are in this place of deep understanding where we can do that. That's kind of the ideal that we're striving for. This is part of the challenge. But we have lesser challenges, just like traffic jams and computer crashes and stubbing our toe and breaking our arms and doing things that we don't want to have happen. But that idea of difficult people, one of the points that Ajahn Brahm made was that just be grateful you're not one of those difficult people. They have to live with themselves. We only have to deal with this difficult person for a little bit. And if you can see that, you can start developing compassion towards those beings who you see as difficult or unpleasant or whatever. And you're much more likely to get a more enlightened response by teaching that respect for that difficult person. But you have to be willing to let go of how you perceive that person. He may be difficult, but he's difficult probably because he's suffering. And when you start to realize that, then you can start opening this heart of compassion. Bodhicitta is the way it's put. And the bodhisattva vows are, however innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. How infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it. However in limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to understand it. And this bodhisattva vow, in the realm of relative truth, it's impossible. You can't do that. Because everybody has to actually free themselves from the suffering. But you can do this part about yourself that puts you in a position that Kshatriyavarjuna was in. You can be in a place where that difficult person is making life very difficult for you. And you can still open your heart to that being. Somebody's told me a story about a counselor who was on the roof with a man who was threatening to commit suicide. He was in a custody battle with his wife. He's holding this baby. He's going to throw the baby off the roof and jump off afterwards because he didn't think his wife would be able to really care for this baby. And the counselor had to talk to him in a really quiet, calm way and understand his situation, his suffering, and allowed the police to get a net under the building and allowed other people to get up onto the roof. And he was able to talk to this man and get him to calm down a little bit and to the place where other people then could actually intervene and prevent him from doing this. And the man kind of thought that the counselor had kind of betrayed him, but he was, I'm sure, grateful later. And that idea of being at ease or being in a difficult situation and not joining the difficulty, refusing to get pulled into this other person's delusions. And it's very difficult to do. When you're in a room with an angry person, you're not separate from that anger. You're feeling that. And if you're in a room with some joyful people, you enjoy that joyfulness as well. And the important thing here is that you can see where it is that you are creating suffering. Because it's only when you can see that you're upset because somebody else is upset or because you have to do something, you know, you can't get your lunch that day or whatever is happening. Well, it just doesn't matter. What matters is that you deal with the situation, and that can be a car accident or somebody giving birth or somebody having a mental breakdown or somebody a fire or floods or whatever is going to be happening more and more in this world as the global warming happens. And we're going to have to learn in our Buddhist practice to be challenged to go beyond what's comfortable. And you don't have to go beyond what's comfortable so much as you have to open your comfort zone. Make that wider. Allow yourself to be able to be in those difficult situations and really open your heart to that. Because that situation really is there to help us. That difficult person is one of our teachers. And that difficult person is showing us something about ourselves that we didn't necessarily want to see, but are really going to help, because it's that place where you just decide to accept whatever that situation is and say, okay, this is it. Let's do the best we can with what we've got. And we may not be able to do it perfectly, but that opening of the heart is what allows that comfort zone to widen. So you're in the situation, you don't want to be there, but I am. I remember a friend of mine who was somewhat reckless. We were up on this mountain together, and he didn't want to go down where there was a trail. He just wanted to go down the side of the mountain. And I found myself in some loose rocks in a very steep mountain, and I stopped, and I thought, I don't want to be here. And then I realized, well, that's the wrong question here. I am here. The question is, how do I get off of this slippery rocks? And his first step was to take giant leaps and just slide down the mountain. And I thought, well, maybe that's for somebody who's a little more athletic. Do we have a plan B? And he said, well, you could take little tiny steps back and zigzag down these rocks. And I could do that. But well, you have to also ask the right question. You have to ask, well, this is what compassion is for. She responds to the calls of the world. And we have to say, help, I don't know what to do here. And that's a really important step because, you know, for a lot of men, they don't want to admit they don't know how to do something. I got to do this. I'm going to do this. And that's how they perceive a challenge. And it's just okay to ask for help. And it's always there. That asking for help is the willingness to recognize my ignorance. And the ignorance is what causes the suffering. And when we can acknowledge that, we can go to that place where you can open your heart to that ignorance. I don't know what to do here. I was with this psychotic woman the other day, and I didn't know what to do. And we worked something out, but it was a very unsatisfactory solution. But that was the best that could come, we could do at the time. And maybe we found out later there's another way to deal with that, which may we have better results. And but you have to acknowledge that. You have to acknowledge that sense of I don't know what to do. And then sometimes just acknowledging that, a door opens, and that you can find a solution to this. There is a way that you can, you know, go through that door to the unknown. But don't take the firing squad. Stay with the practice, no matter how difficult it gets. But that's what River Master Jiyu said when she came from Japan. She said, well, it was difficult, but I got what I came for. And she got it because she got to the place where she was fed up with this prejudice, fed up with the beatings, fed up with the difficulties. And she packed her suitcase. She was going to go out the door, and something inside her said, well, you know, you could be wrong. And she turned around and went back. And that's when things started opening up for her spiritually. And later she said, I hear this voice said, well, you could be right. And there was a lovely Indian prayer I was reading the other day that said, teach me how to trust my heart. Teach me how to trust my mind. Teach me how to trust my intuition. Teach me how to trust that intuitive understanding within ourselves. And this is what you're learning in Buddhist practice, is you're learning to trust the mind, the heart mind. And learning to recognize when you're confronted with ignorance and acknowledge that. And trust something, there is a solution. I don't know what it is at the moment, but there is a solution. And the solution is bring your meditation to this situation. realize that every step is a prayer, every incident in your life is a prayer. Every incident is an opportunity. And when we're confronted by that ignorance, acknowledge that. It's just okay to not be, know everything. There are people who almost always know everything. When I was in Italy at this hotel, and the man behind the desk turns around and gives us our key without our even asking for it. He knew. And I said, "Well, how'd you know that was us?" And he says, "I know everything." So the last day it was raining and we came in, and I said, "Well, how long is this rain going to last?" "I don't know," he says. And I said, "Well, I thought you knew everything." He said, "Almost everything." And our ability to deal with difficult people is just exactly what we're here to learn in the monastery. She said the monastery was like a rock tumbler. And I'm showing Pat around this morning, and she said, "Well, all rocks are gems. There's a gem in every rock." And that's what those rock tumblers do, is that they polish those rocks and turn them into gems. That's what Kishta Garba does. And she said, well, her job in the monastery was just throw in more grit. And the monks all bump their shoulders together and run across their difficulties and get the chip knocked off their shoulders from time to time. And it is difficult to live with 20 other people or 25 other people, and it's always going to be their fault. But sometimes it's not their fault. Sometimes it's my ability to change my perception. Sometimes I can open my heart. And as Basso said, sometimes it's good to do and sometimes it's not. And sometimes I can do this and sometimes I can't. And give yourself the patience and give yourself the room to be able to understand your ignorance. And you know, you have to when you get older like me. Your memory doesn't improve with age. Especially remembering names. Give yourself space to just be who you are. And sometimes it's somebody who's old, sometimes it's somebody who's impulsive and impatient. And knowing that, you can open this heart of compassion to yourself as well as to others is really what our practice is about. And every day is an opportunity, so take it. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.